Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Midtown Business Radio.
Welcome to Midtown Business Radio. I'm your host, Michael Lauer, and we have a great show for you guys today. Later on, we'll be visiting from Marshall Cease with Mowgli and Tim Borchers with Atlanta Streetcar. But first, we have Mike Lesage and John Williams from Bonelick Barbecue. How are you guys doing today?
Doing all right. How
doing
are you?
Good. How are you?
Doing good, man. Just glad to be back at work, having a full week. It's kind of weird having an uninterrupted week of work with weather related, right? It's crazy.
Need a break.
Yeah, well, you actually got stuck there, didn't you, Mike?
Yeah, I was there both snowstorms.
He's insane.
The snow and the snowmageddon.
He slept on our skee ball table.
Nice. Yeah. So was that on purpose? So you could eat all the barbecue you wanted to?
Well, the first one, I was just trying to get to the restaurant and get my employees out of there because I realized it was taking me 4 hours to get 5 miles.
Yeah, it was a nightmare. Yeah,
it was a mess. So I got there to get all of my employees out, and I just figured I would, run the restaurant by myself or with one other person, and then there was no getting out of there. So
Right. Basically
wound up staying there for 3 days. And the second time around, I just decided to pack a bag because I figured it was going to be the same thing. And there's not a lot of restaurants in the neighborhood. So
yeah, if you're the only one open, you can.
So you stay open. I guess you got some business. I know Waffle House did, and they got a lot of business. Yeah. So you guys actually did pretty well over the snowstorm then.
Mike did very well over the storm.
We also, it was a good chance to meet and greet a lot of people that had not been in, if you're stuck on a block,
right,
and you've not been to a place before, you're going to go check it out.
Especially if it's the only one open. That kind of narrows it down, right?
It's a good opportunity to get to know the neighbors.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That was a smart move, man. So tell me a little bit about Bonelick Barbecue. What makes it special?
Bonelick Barbecue is it's my baby. We've been doing, we take the best barbecue ideas from around the country. We don't really stick to one particular theme. A lot of places are, specialize in North Carolina or Kansas City style or Texas style. And what we do is I've spent years traveling the country playing music, and barbecue was one of the things. It was always the go-to. And so we decided to basically build a menu that was taking the best of all those different things and putting them under one roof
I think we've done that
kind of like
well.
A tour, right?
Yeah, basically.
Okay, cool.
But, finding the best techniques and really focusing more so on putting out a quality product and having a little bit of diversity in there rather than trying to pigeonhole into one particular flavor.
So, Mike, you are the owner,
yes,
correct? And, John, what's your role there?
Oh, I'm the general manager.
General manager. Mm-hmm. Okay. So who's running the show now? You guys?
We both do.
Autopilot.
Yeah.
Autopilot. Nice. Good that you have people that you can use. So how many employees do you have?
About 30.
Wow, so you guys, you've been around how long?
About a year and a half.
So for around a year and a half, and you already have 30 employees.
Yeah.
That's
about 30.
That's pretty impressive.
It's a pretty big headache.
You need them, right?
Yeah, that's it.
Can't do it without them.
It's a good problem to have.
Yeah, absolutely.
Needing more people. So you mentioned that you play music. What do you play?
I mostly sing and play guitar. I spent years and years traveling all over the country playing, and then I moved to Atlanta, played music here for a long time, and then once Bonelick kind of started, I've had less and less time for doing that these days.
So. Is that why they call you the rock and roll chef?
That's it.
So yeah. Tell me about that. How did that come out?
I don't know. Basically, kind of like moving to Atlanta. When I moved here,
you were playing a lot of music back then.
We were on the road nonstop, and when I moved here, I didn't know anybody, so it was... I started this party on Monday nights at my house called Meat Mondays.
That's actually one of the first places I met him.
Yeah.
It was at the
Meat Mondays. Okay.
Yeah.
And it was basically just inviting tons of musicians over and lots of industry people as well, So it was kind of a good way to meet the kind of people that I wanted to get to know in the city. So it just kind of went crazy. The first week we had 12 people show up at the house, and within 6-8 months, it was over 100
people
showing
up
every week.
Wow, so that really exploded, yeah.
Yeah. So, it was, and that was kind of where Bonelick got started.
So you were actually cooking for these people.
Yeah, it was basically trying out
all
the barbecue restaurants.
Yeah.
Oh, M-E-A-T, so did you have a little pun there, or did you just, as a M-E-E-T, Monday?
We didn't really make flyers for it.
Oh, okay. Unless it was all word of mouth, that's actually even more impressive.
Yeah. But so it was a lot of musicians and stuff like that, and I think that's where the somebody somebody was like, you need to get rockandrollchef.com. So I wound up getting it. I still have done nothing with it, but yeah.
But you have it.
That's where
you own it.
That's where the moniker came from, I think. So.
So how did that develop into starting your own business?
Well, the...
It started at Pacin when... Pacin, he was a sous chef at Pacin, and they were closed on Mondays. And after the party started to grow, Mike had the idea to move it to Pacin. And so the guys at Pacin, he asked them if they mind him opening it up on Monday. And they were like, oh, that's fine. So he did. And then in 2010, Atlanta Magazine named it the best barbecue in Atlanta. And I think that's when they decided they should move forward on this.
Yeah. So this kind of went from the next step from there, but yeah.
So did you take John on board when you started immediately, or when did
Jonathan, like I said, Jonathan and I met shortly after I moved here.
Right when
here.
You came in
and,
yeah, from it, Jacksonville.
Yeah, and he's been one of my best friends ever since. It was kind
okay.
of,
I worked the Meat Mondays. Not the Meat Mondays, but the Mondays at Pacin barbecue. So the only time I worked at Pacin was with you on Monday.
Yeah.
And then.
What was your day job?
My day job, I was a bartender. So
okay.
At the time, I was working at two other bars, and then I was working one day a week over with Mike. And
so it just kind of seemed a perfect fit when we were finally opening the brick and mortar of Bone Lick that would Jonathan be there, because he was kind of there from the inception of it.
It was pretty intuitive. It just kind of And of course you were all on board, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely.
That's cool. You can get someone to, and a lot of times people go into business together. It can be stressful on the friendship.
Right.
Have you guys found that that's pretty, you guys work pretty well together in the professional world?
We kind of work ridiculously well
together.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know how we haven't gotten to the point where we've hit each other yet, but we haven't.
No.
Somehow it works.
It's funny. We both, I think we both know each other's strengths and weaknesses, you know. We're both kind of good at getting each other's backs on that kind of stuff. So I don't know. It's actually turned out to be a dynamite relationship.
Yeah.
Let's make out a little bit. You want to make out a little bit?
Yeah, a little off air.
Off air. Were you guys doing your own time?
No, but it's kind of funny because Jonathan is, you know, I constantly have ideas like, oh, I know how we can make this place better. And Jonathan's one of the only people that I've ever worked with where he's just like, yeah, let's do it. Let's do that right now.
Yeah,
you know,
why not?
No matter what it is. Like we just added a stage. We decided we wanted to add live music to the mix at Bone Lick. And
we built that stage in 45 minutes.
Is it safe?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
No,
it's solid.
All right.
It's solid
but
as hell.
We were doing an event and he wanted to have, we were having a band play and he wanted to have a stage that night.
Sure.
And, so it's like 2 o'clock and the event starts at 6 and he gives me a list of supplies to run to home. Yeah,
yeah.
Mike gives me a list to run to Depot. And he's like, I need you to go get these things. We're building a stage today.
I'm sure we can have it done in an hour.
Okay. So yeah, like hours before the event starts, we build a stage, in Bone Lick so we can have a stage for the band, and it worked out perfect. It was great.
Is it the same stage? Have you added to it or anything like that?
Well, basically, we took that stage and we knew that we were going to add live music to the mix. But
eventually.
Yeah. So, but that just made it. It was one of those things. If the stage
solidified
was there, then
it.
I've got to do it right now. So,
right.
So we did that. And we've spent the last, you know, couple months like beefing up the sound system in there.
Sure.
That kind of deal. But
what kind of music do you guys usually have in there?
Right now, we're doing a lot of Americana type stuff. Like tonight, Tuesday nights, it's called the Outlaw Open Jam. So we've got
that's a lot of fun.
Bunch of the regulars to kind of get together, and we just play a bunch of old like Hank and Willie and Waylon and that kind of stuff. And then on the weekends, we've been getting in, it's mostly kind of Americana rock and roll and garage rock type stuff. So we're basically trying to stick under that umbrella for the time being.
Local.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Kind of aspiring.
We've got some regional acts that have come through. There's a guy named Matt Woods that's touring nonstop. He's been in a couple of times. Another guy, Pete Stein, that's constantly touring.
Sure.
He's coming through quite
a bit. So they come through. When they come through, they go to you guys.
Yep.
So when you have... You advertise this on your board and that stuff like that, but is there a cover, or do you guys just, you know, come in, enjoy the food, enjoy the...
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Just come in and enjoy
it's,
the...
It's, in doing that, if we had a cover, it'd be hard to kind of separate the two, you know, and somebody wants to come in and eat. I'm not going to charge them to come in and eat. I'm
already right. I mean, you're getting their money because they're going to get some food or a drink or whatever.
Yeah, that's it. So.
So how do you distinguish yourself from the hundreds of other barbecue places in Atlanta? I mean, there's a lot.
There are a lot.
We are the best.
Well, one of the things that distinguishes us, we kind of have more of a spicy flair to our barbecue. I mean, just the most obvious. Georgia has a lot of sweet barbecue and a lot of places that do that well. There's not really many places in Georgia where you can get a spicier side of the barbecue. And that's one of the things that Mike wanted to do from the beginning was a barbecue that had a spice to it because he felt that in Georgia that just wasn't represented. So that was one of the, I think, first things that separates us from other barbecue places.
Yeah, I think the big, bold flavors, that was part of it. Also, another thing that distinguishes us, I think, quite a bit is the environment. We're not a mom-and-pop place. We've got a really kind of cool, fun rock and roll vibe going in the place. I mean, for example, like music, most places you go into, there's a playlist playing, you know, whether it's Spotify or Pandora or whatever. Yeah. We have two turntables set up, and we've got hundreds and hundreds of records, you know. So we do all vinyl all the time. The customers can go pick out their records and throw them on.
Customers like going through them and picking what's coming up next. So we have like an up next station where any customer can come up, look through the vinyl, pick out a record, put it up there, and then their record will be played next. And that's been very popular. People love that.
Just come up and do it? Or you like
you just come up and do it. No, you just come up and do it.
So it's a free jukebox.
Basically, yeah.
With a little retro feel to it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's cool, man.
So we do that, and then as far as the food goes, everything that we do, you know, I've been a chef most of my adult life, so it was, you know, creating a place that was more of a chef-driven barbecue spot versus, you know, nothing comes out of a can, you know. Everything's made from scratch, down to the butter, down to the mayo. Everything's homemade.
Wow, so you don't buy any, you just buy the ingredients and make the
food. That's
it,
yeah.
We don't make the tater tots. That we don't make.
We've tried it.
Everything
else. It's a
real
pain in the butt.
It's not worth the time.
No.
Not at all.
Tell me more about the food. What's your most popular dish?
Our ribs are, we can't keep
them.
We
go through a lot of ribs.
Yeah, it's nuts.
They're really good. They've got a nice spicy rub on them, and they're just nice and tender. The ribs are probably my favorite.
Definitely probably our biggest seller. That, the pulled pork. And the brisket, I think, are the three things that we just
we've got
can't
a lot of good. We've got a lot of good feedback from our brisket as well. A lot of people from Texas seem to like it.
Well, aside from getting people in for events and music, I know it's usually a big part of the business to do catering. How much catering do you guys do?
Tons, and that's this year's kind of we started at the beginning of the year of really kind of taking more of a focus on. Catering, putting more of an emphasis on that. Last year, it was kind of more of a, you know, kind of flying by the seat of our pants on it a lot. And it got out of control. We were so busy with the catering.
We finally have someone specifically designated to take care of that.
We had to bring
that's
in.
That's smart, yeah.
Yeah, there's got
that's a self-sustaining business on its own.
Yeah.
It was just too much to do for anyone who has already had a lot on their plate.
We have this guy, Mike Zimmer, that I actually met at the Atlanta Barbecue Festival last year, and him and I wound up working together on a couple of catering events in the last quarter of last year, and we sat down at the beginning of the year, started brainstorming. He's from Louisiana. He has his background is mostly in Cajun foods, and that's my jam. I love that stuff.
Cajun food is awesome.
It's where I learn how to cook. Right. You know, I learn from going down to New Orleans. He's from northern Louisiana. But so him and I kind of got together. We started brainstorming. And he does a lot of barbecue as well already. But he's kind of just a one-man show. So we decided to kind of collaborate on that. And so he's now running the catering side of our business. And we've included some of those, you know, just great traditional Louisiana you know, staples sure. into the mix as well. So it's kind of turned out to be a good thing. I think it's going to be – it offers a little bit more than just barbecue. You know, so when yeah. you're catering, we're able to, you know, offer
Diversify a little bit, right.
Yeah, exactly.
Because, I mean, barbecue is great, but that differentiates you from the other places that cater
exactly.
to.
So that's exactly.
Huge. All right, so for the listeners that don't know, we are here in Atlantic Station. You guys are going to be back here on March 1st. Is that correct? You'll be here for the Beer, Bourbon, and Barbecue Festival?
Yes, we are.
Yes, we are.
We are. Can't wait.
So you guys have a booth there with some samples, or how's that going to work?
Yeah, we'll be there. I actually won't be there. Jonathan,
yeah, I'll be there.
Okay,
I'll be.
Tell
giving
what
out
you're
going to
be doing, Johnny.
I'm going to be giving out barbecue samples. Drinking a lot of beer. I'm going to try to stay away from the bourbon as much as I can,
as much as possible.
Yeah, a lie. That's a lie.
Yes,
don't try too hard, man. It all goes pretty well together.
You know, at least for the first half of the day when we're giving out samples, shaking hands, but
kissing babies, all that stuff.
Yeah, you know, the regular stuff. But we're going to have a lot of fun. There's going to be a lot of Atlanta breweries there. Monday night, for one, which we have, we carry a lot of Monday night yeah. stuff at Bone
There's
Lake.
Some good stuff.
They're our neighbor brewery right down the street
okay,
from
cool.
us. So, but yeah, I'm excited about it. It's going to be a lot of fun.
So aside from people finding you at the Beer, Bourbon, and Barbecue Festival in Atlantic Station on March 1st, where can they go to learn more about you guys, where you're located, website, phone number, all that good stuff?
We are at 1133 Huff Road, which is just off of Howell Mill. It's in the bottom of the Apex apartment complex. We are on the internets at
get us on Facebook,
www.bonelickbarbecue.com.
And you can spell that either way right now.
No.
BBQ or barbecue. No, I'll just BBQ.
Yeah.
Go to BBQ.
Okay. BBQ.
Well, I enjoyed having you guys on the show. It's been great. I got to check you guys out. I got to admit, I haven't been by, but I will. That sounds awesome. So how do you guys feel about sticking with us while we hang with our next guest?
Absolutely.
Hey, sounds great.
All right, great. Our next guest is Marshall Cease from Mowgli. Did I get that right, Marshall?
You did, yeah.
Great. So tell me a little bit about what Mowgli is.
So Mowgli is a music technology company that really focuses on creating applications that inspire and enable creativity for those who might not think they're creative, especially in the world of music.
So explain what some of those applications might be.
Sure. So the first product we launched was something called Songster, which was a social game on Facebook. If you think about Farmville and Cityville, where Zynga had people making fake farms and fake cities, and I thought, well, what if we use that kind of platform to make real music? So we built this really cool web technology where you could take, essentially build a musical collage. We would chop up songs into their loop component parts, vocals, lead, bass, and drums, put all those into the system and let people kind of rearrange them, mix them up with other songs, and form their own new works out of that. And then we built kind of a game system around that where you're leveling up your rock star, having to tour around the city, et cetera, et cetera. So that was kind of the impetus, and that gave birth to our second product and kind of where we're headed now.
So more about Songster. So when you sourced all this music, did you pull it from other places? Did you create it? How did you do that?
Great question. So we started off, I got a partnership with a company called Big Fish Audio, who's known kind of for selling loops to producers out there who are actually composing.
Libraries,
you know,
and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, exactly. And so we took all of their stuff, put them, you know, packaged it up into what we called a song pack.
Sure.
Put that in there, and then we would source just tons of indie content from, you know, just a lot of my friends and people I knew, and just kind of expanded from there. About a year into it, I started to work with the major labels and music publishers to really, you know, start getting
sure.
stuff people recognized. You know, took a while to generate those relationships, but that's now, you know, 80% of the content that we're bringing in comes from our major partners.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So about the platform you guys, did you guys do the Candy Crush method where you made it cheap and then to buy more song packs and stuff like that, you charge? How'd you guys do
yeah,
that?
Yeah, we've always kind of tried to go for that freemium model.
Sure. It works, man.
It does.
I'm a victim. It's
something that looks a lot more simple than it really is. And
we've
been tracking an obscene amount of analytics trying to figure out user behavior patterns and what gets people to that threshold of wanting to buy and what they want to buy. And in the world of music, people don't want to buy music. So it's not as simple as just monetizing the content.
Sure.
So Songster, we actually sunset in favor of Mashup DJ, which is the product we have currently now. And it's not a Facebook game. It's you play it at mashupdj.com, or you can download it on your iPad. And it's more of a, if you can think about like an Instagram where you're playing professional photographer
sure.
and sharing your work so that other people can look and see. same thing with Mashup DJ. You're basically creating your own music, posting that, and then people can look and actually dig in and what we call remash that and create new works out of what other people have created there too. So the same kind of freemium model there. And then we all of that kind of rests on top of our technology platform that we've built to run all of this, which is great because it's really flexible and you can build a lot of other applications on it. So our team's pretty hard at work right now building a new game that'll be a little bit more of the Candy Crush kind of model where you're kind of playing around with this puzzle game that ends up creating music.
Oh, wow. So when you create a song, you share it through all your social media. Does it work that way, or is it just through Mashup DJ?
It does, yeah. So we connect all the standard social media for people to share. And what's great is that when you really inspire that creative artist in somebody who's maybe not typically doing anything creative during the day, they actually feel a genuine sense of pride. So even though they're using other people's music and creating something new, it's the same way as I feel when I write a song. You know, that pride of authorship carries forward, and then people want to share it. It's not like, hey, you just bought a purple cow, do you want to share this to your Facebook
friends?
Do you
want to share everyone the purple cow you just paid $5 for? No, I really don't.
Right. Can we hide that so nobody ever knows? Can you destroy all the evidence?
This never happened. So when you started Mashup DJ, did you keep Songster running, or did you have to
swing from
one or the other? So Songster is no longer.
Yes, that's if you were one of our users, we got some mementos, and maybe, you know, if anything happens like decades from now, I'll sell it on eBay for retirement.
There you go. So when you start up the next one, is Mashup DJ still going to keep going?
Yes. Mashup DJ, I kind of view as the hub. So, you know, in my perfect world, we could have all these different applications, all these different games where ultimately you're having fun playing the game, but you're still making music. And all that music, as we continue to bring more and more content into the platform, funnels down into Mashup DJ. And it's what's really great is that, you know, it's hard to find really interesting mashups of Blue Oyster Cult and Passion Pit, you know, but you can get that on our platform. So from a listening perspective, you know, as we get more and more content, it's definitely unique stuff.
So did you have to like ASCAP and BCM, that kind of stuff, or like how do you do the rights to perpetuity?
So on the performing rights side of things, we are licensing everything direct from the publishers because we already have to go straight to the publishers to get the rights to modify and change the music around, and they have to ask their writers for that kind of permission. It doesn't make sense for us to have to also go to ASCAP, BMI, CSAC. So we just license all the rights that we need directly from the publishers.
And that's worked successfully for you guys so far?
It has, yeah.
I'm sure they're thrilled. I mean, it gets their stuff out there too, right?
Absolutely. It's been really cool to see some people just how much they love the bands because they're hearing the hooks and the loops over and over and over again, and now they feel like they're a part of the process. So that kind of fan is really cool to watch, and they love the bands even more because of it.
Right. I can see that. So you mentioned that you write music.
Yes.
So is that your background? Tell me your path to Mowgli.
It was a weird one, man. I have been a musician my whole life, but I decided I'd take my parents' advice and go do a backup plan before trying to do music, and so I went to law school. And then 3 years after law school and 7 years of practicing law and millions of pages of contracts read, I decided that's not really what I wanted to be doing with my life. And my life mantra has always been create, connect. I create music to connect with people. And it was always a very personal thing for me. And then I was kind of hit over the head with this idea that actually that's something that should be really outward. And I needed to make something that would enable anybody to create and connect and experience that same kind of feeling that drives me to do my music.
Sure.
So, and that was so powerful that it literally made me quit my law job and pursue Mowgli full time.
So nice. Was it pretty much just you doing this, or do you have some people that you worked with? Or
no, yeah, I was lucky to have some really great friends who had very complementary skill sets, whether it's on the technology side or the operations side. And so, you know, we built a team that was working at night and weekends and beer and pizza for a year before we took on investment funding to really kind of bring people on full time and try to go all out. But yeah, no, definitely. There's no possible way it could have been just me. I'm just thankful people bought into this crazy hairband scheme I had.
So personally, what's next for you? Where do you see this going?
Yeah, so you know, we've been around for about 3 years now, and I feel like my skill set is more of, you know, I can get something going and I can get it to a point where somebody else can take over and really guide it. I'm not the operations guy. I'm kind of the starter guy.
Inception kind of.
Yeah. So we have a phenomenal investment partner, another gaming company based up in Cumming called Xavient. And their CEO has taken over the CEO reins of Mowgli to really kind of plan out our, you know, next suite of products and stuff. So I've focused on our strategic partnerships, all the label publisher stuff. But, you know, it's now I actually, for the first time in my life, get to pursue my own music, which is
cool.
Nice. Yeah, after 10 years of law and entrepreneurship.
You're going to play at Bone Lick?
Hey, well, yeah, we should talk.
Yeah, let's do it.
It is that kind of Americana vibe. So
yeah, right on. Let me know.
Cool.
So your goal is to pretty much sell your company and work on your music full time.
I mean, I just want Mowgli to exist. It doesn't really matter to me if it, you know, I want it to exist, and to do that, it needs to make money, and whatever happens after that happens. But, you know, I'm
right.
Really passionate about kind of why we created it. So I don't, selling it is not really necessarily something that I
just
I
turning
need to
it
happen,
over.
But
then.
Yeah, just I'm really proud of the fact that it's existing, you know, with me and, kind of more of a backseat role. So
sure.
That's exciting to me.
I can really appreciate how hard it is to start something up. What do you think was the hardest thing, obstacle for you to overcome as you got this off the ground and running?
Wow, there's so many.
Well, then name a couple. I mean, just go for
it. Yeah, I would say persistence is the key, not losing faith. And that's the hardest part, because when you start off, you realize you think you're like climbing up Stone Mountain. You're just going to kind of walk
right
leisurely. And then there's like some clouds. And you get up to the clouds and you're like, you're a year in. You look up and you're like, oh, crap. This is actually Mount Everest.
Yeah.
You're like, I don't really want to go down either. So you just keep going. And I think it's maintaining that faith, you know, and because you're going to get thrown an obscene amount of obstacles, and if you don't truly
you're have
believe
every reason not to do it.
Exactly.
Yeah, I was gonna
and
ask.
You gotta have passion, man. Like, I don't understand people who start companies and who don't really love what they do. They're just doing it for the money. Like, I can't even fathom that mindset. Like, if I wasn't insanely passionate about what we were doing and why we were doing it, there's no way I could have devoted the time and energy it took to
it, get it just wouldn't have been worth it.
No.
Is that what you guys found, Mike and John? It's the same thing for getting your guys off the ground?
It just sounded very very familiar, the things he was saying about just pushing forward. I mean, Mike knows better than me, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, if I wouldn't still be doing, I wouldn't be working in the restaurant industry, period, if I wasn't passionate about
sure.
it. It's for it's suicidal
tough.
People.
It's cutthroat, man.
It's nuts. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Marshall, did you understand the technical aspect of this, or did you pretty much just had to find people to do that for you?
I did. I mean, my undergrad degree was management information systems, so I knew how to build technology, at least from a small perspective before
sure.
I went on the law side. But it let me at least, you know, talk with our CTO intelligently, and I could, you know, help him on some very high-level architectural
sure.
you know, issues and stuff like that. You don't want me coding anything. I don't even think I could do Hello World in today's technologies, but... but yeah, it's that definitely helped tremendously on the product development side of things.
Sure. So aside from persistence and passion, what other traits do you think make a successful entrepreneur?
To me, I always kind of look at it through these three things. Like, are you down with OPP? and you know, persistence is one of those.
Sure.
Passion is the other one that we kind of talked about. And O is being open. Because I've seen too many stubborn people out there who just kind of refuse to take other people's advice and go down. And it's a blend, because you can't just be a yes man and agree with what everyone is saying and just
right.
listen to everyone's advice. It's this kind of blend of, you know what you want and you have an idea of how to get there, but you're willing and open to listen to what other people's suggestions. And I think it's through that process and the persistence and the passion. If you have those three things, it might take some time, but...
It's a balancing act at a sprint.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, getting how to pivot, you know.
I always thought OPP meant something else. It's weird.
Learn something new every day, man. That's why we have the show.
Yeah. Well, now we know.
That's right. So where can people go to learn more about you guys and find some of your products?
I would say mashupdj.com is the place to go. If you want to learn more about the company, you can go to mowgli.co.
And what about for your music?
Abandonedmusic.com. Although I'm about to release a new record, so it's all... If you go there now, you're not going to see or hear anything relevant. But in the next couple months,
you'll find
abandonedmusic.com. Well, yeah, we'll get up there.
All right. That sounds great. Well, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mind hanging out with us? We'll do one more guest.
No, I'd love to.
All right, last but certainly not least, we have Tim Borchers with Atlanta Streetcar. How are you doing today, Tim?
Good, Michael, thanks.
Good, you have an amazing accent.
Well, it's very southern, very
far. Yeah, I was going to say, you're from what, Mississippi, South Carolina? South.
It's a southern hemisphere, so it's Australia.
All right, so Australia from down under. What brought you to America?
About 12 years ago, I was offered a position managing a streetcar system in Tampa, Florida. And I was single at the time and thought I'd take the opportunity. It was close to Disney and the beaches, and it would be an interesting 2 or 3 years vacation. That was 12 years ago.
So you've had an extended vacation, but you are not in Disney anymore.
No, I've been with the Atlanta Streetcar Project now for almost 12 months as their executive director.
So explain a little bit about your day-to-day with Atlanta Streetcar.
Well, day-to-day is to take it through construction, where there's been many challenges and much more successes, and into operations.
So tell me about why you're here with Streetcar. Why Atlanta?
Atlanta system was a very interesting one. For a streetcar system to be successful, it had to have a couple of things. First of all, it had to have the will of the people. And this is a project where I believe overall it has the will of the people. It has to have political will. And Kasim Reed, the mayor, is sort of initiating the political will. And it has to have the money. And the project received the highest ever Tiger II grant. So it had all the things necessary for success. The choice of the vehicles, the choice of the route, and the projected extensions, it was probably one of the best news stories for streetcar that I'd seen in North America lately.
So what stage in the process are we at now in Atlanta?
Well, we're getting very close to completion of construction. About a week ago, two of the first new streetcars, the Siemens S70, slipped into town at 96,500 pounds and 80 foot long. So we would expect to see the first streetcar moving, hopefully near the end of April, and we would be ready for revenue service in June. Remembering we'll be having a soft opening, a little bit like a theme park.
Sure.
We'll be running the streetcars, getting all the bugs out, getting them on time, and then just one day opening the doors up and doing it with passengers.
So where are the routes right now, so people listening can kind of go, okay, that's me?
Well, you'll see them in the track in the street, all the tracks down. There's about 40, 50 feet of concrete left to pour. It's starting out at the Martin Luther King Center, running along Edgewood and Auburn, downtown to Centennial Park. So it's about 2.7 miles total length.
Well, it sounds like you guys are well on your way with that one. But there have got to have been challenges that came with that. So what are some obstacles that you guys overcame in the process in Atlanta?
When I arrived, the cars had already been purchased, and they'd been purchased for a very good price, and it's one of the most popular streetcars and light rail vehicles to be used, not just in the US, there's several hundred of them here, but also overseas. There were some issues with the utilities. As soon as you open up the ground in downtown Atlanta, there's masses of cables and pipes. And it's okay for the ones that you know that are there, that you plan around, but there were many more that were undiscovered. And so that was a challenge initially, yes.
Well, you probably discovered them.
Right? Well, you certainly, right. as you dug them out, sometime they would take a shovel and a pick and do it by hand just so we didn't damage anything.
Sure.
But we got a good plan together. We focused some key logistic folk on that, and we overcame that issue.
Is that a common problem that you found in your career doing this?
Utilities?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. It's a problem with older cities and larger cities, and Atlanta has both those characteristics.
So in Tampa, was it a similar problem there, or do you guys have a different set there?
Tampa has a lot of sand, and it makes it sort of easier to negotiate. Also, the places where the streetcar was running had a minimal number of utilities, so it wasn't such a big issue.
So tell me about your background, especially in Australia. What's your pathway? Aside from just having this opportunity, what did you do in Australia beforehand?
Well, it's interesting to hear the other guys. When I was 11 years old, my grandparents bought me an all-day streetcar ticket. We call them trams in Australia. And so I trotted over and stepped on the tram, and I remember it was a 1924 Bernie safety car made in Philadelphia, USA. And all of a sudden, I was just went like I was on something. You know, I started hearing the noises and smelling the smells, and from that day I was hooked. Now, my path in life should have been an Episcopalian minister. At the very minimum, I was to be an attorney, as my sister is. But instead of that, I followed the streetcar line of work. and I became involved as a tradesperson at a very early age. I worked for the largest streetcar system in the world, which is in Melbourne, Australia, down the bottom of Australia. When I was there, they had about 120 miles of double track and about 700 streetcars. And I ended up...
That's a lot.
It was big, but I wanted sort of a system that was more bite-sized. So I ended up managing the second largest system, which had 33 cars, which was also in Victoria. And it was from there, the manager of that tramway system, I became the streetcar manager in Tampa, Florida.
So this has got to be kind of like tiny compared to what you're used to, right? As far as scope of project, right?
Yes. Yes, it is. Yeah. It does have other challenges, though. Although there's a streetcar renaissance going around all around America and the world, it's still new to a lot of people because it's a new industry. So there are challenges. But yes, on the big scheme, this is a small system, which is how the FTA, the Federal Transit Administration, likes it. They want you to put in a small system. If all goes well, then okay, let's extend it. This particular system is a very good design as well, though. It actually replicates the old circulator system of the original streetcars,
sure,
which had the highest success, and also the highest ridership and the highest economic development.
So, yeah, the key is to start small and right and then get it big, I'm sure. But so what are your plans of expansion when this does succeed?
Well, the extensions for the streetcar are planned to follow the Beltline, basically. There is a small area left where you could put in a streetcar right of way. The streetcars we have, they're not trains. They're very, very quiet. They're low floor, so you can step on them, step into them. You can wheel a wheelchair or a bicycle in and out, and they fit well into an urban environment. So basically, the extension is around the Beltline. And I should say now that this isn't necessarily a new idea. It's being done at the moment in Paris, France. And you've heard the comments that, well,
right,
this is Atlanta, it's not Paris. We have traffic congestion problems.
Oh, yeah.
We have air quality problems.
Sure.
And we have a new generation of people who are looking for an alternative way of getting around, whether it's walking or cycling, and like to live close to where they work and party close to where they work. And that's all the things that Paris has, and that's all the things that Atlanta has. So this Beltline project in Paris, they're building it in sections, a bit like the one is planned here. And the only problem they have, I've been over there twice to have a look at it, is every time they open an extension, they're inundated with passengers because people just want to go over to that lifestyle.
Yeah, people like to think that America has to do it differently. But I think that you're absolutely right. People are kind of changing their attitude of the way they need to move around and transport themselves. So how much do you think this will cut down on emissions? Because you mentioned the clean air.
That's one of the things that we'll do. Just an example, you know, people say, well, what will a streetcar do? We're not going to use it. Well, you know, if you don't use it, that's okay, because every streetcar will take off 177 automobiles. No, so that's a lot of emissions. That's also a lot of room on the road. So even if you say, I'm not going to use the streetcar, the 177 automobiles that come off the road are going to make more room for you.
So when I think streetcar, I think of those old historic ones, like in New Orleans, that we were talking about New Orleans earlier. What are the style of these kind of going to look like?
This is something you would expect to see in a European city. It's a Siemens S70. Siemens actually made the first streetcars in the world. It's 100% American built, but very much on a European design, used throughout the world. They're sleek, they're quiet, they're very, very modern, and low floor, so you can step on and off the cars.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the sound. So they're actually quite quiet.
They have a thing called resilient wheels, which they have rubber packing between the steel tires and the steel wheel centers. So they're whisper quiet, yes.
So you guys really went in detail on the plans for this thing. You didn't, you know, cut any corners on this.
Oh, an amount of value engineering was done to minimize cost. But as far as selecting the streetcars, it was certainly the right selection. These are like a light rail vehicle in disguise. At the moment, they'll do 35 miles an hour, but they'll be running typically this speed of traffic. With a two-hour software change, they'll perform like a MARTA train with a top speed of 65 miles an hour. So although it looks like a streetcar around town, if one day if it decides to share the MARTA system or run further out to the suburbs, it can run at a higher speed.
I was going to ask about that. Is this some kind of, are you stepping on MARTA's toes at all? How does that kind of work?
Now, this is the mile connectivity. So these systems are designed to be streetcars and run in the street. You'll see that MARTA trains don't run in the street at all. So you can step on, go for a short ride, step back off again, and to supplement and feed into as other systems like bus systems or the MARTA system. The streetcar has many different reasons. You know, one purpose is for carrying passengers. And a lot of people say, well, will the streetcar work in this experiment? Well, so far, all the streetcar systems that have opened up the new starts in the last 10 years in America, Australia, or Europe have been completely successful. Just to let you know how successful, in Portland, Oregon in 2002, they opened their first streetcar system. They carried 1.4 people. By 2010, they carried 3.9 million people. So from 1.4 to 3.9 million. So we know that as a transit operation, it carries people. But streetcars actually built cities. And you notice that major cities have a very busy urban city core, high density, and then these satellite suburbs, which they originally called streetcar suburbs. Now, what happened is when you bring this, take the streetcar out, over a period of 20 to 40 to 50 years, you start getting urban decay. And so these areas in the city you see that buildings, that there's spaces or the buildings are empty or decaying, is urban decay. When they're putting the streetcars back in, it's re-establishing the centres and building out those suburbs again. In Portland, apart from carrying the passengers, in the first 10 years of streetcar operation, more than half of all the new development was along the streetcar route.
Because so this is an economic epicenter we're building.
It's an economic development tool. So originally for transit, originally for economic development. What happened back in the early days of Atlanta, everybody had to live around their work and their shopping. People who wanted to live outside of town couldn't get in. So the land developers would buy cheap tracts of land, build a streetcar system, build a suburb, and transit the people backwards and forwards on a streetcar. And that's what it does. It causes economic development. Along the route, you start getting businesses. I can tell you, when I first arrived, there was a number of real estate agents that I spoke to that came here from Portland. They heard we were building a streetcar, and they wanted to start looking at land to buy because they wanted the same economic game as they had in Portland. So, yes, you will find the for sale signs will be going along, going from all the streetcar route. I'll be honest with you, I bought my apartment on the streetcar route. I wanted to be close to work, plus I wanted the economic gain of living near the streetcar.
Why not, right?
Why not? You already see the Edgewood corridor, you know, becoming more and more popular, and that definitely has something to do with, you know, with the streetcar route.
Can we get a streetcar route going next to Bonelick?
Bonelick. Yeah.
Well, if you have a look at the Martin Luther King area, there's some areas there where there's available space for build out. If you have a look at Beale Street and New Orleans,
right.
There's one thing they both have in common, and they have a streetcar feeding them. Now, I believe we're going to see similar but a more localized development once the streetcar starts running here in Atlanta.
Around the same time we were opening up Bonelick, we purchased another restaurant that was for sale that was along that same route. And it was because the streetcar was coming in. It's obviously...
So that influenced your tendency of what to buy because of the streetcar.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
You have to think about it. Atlanta gets large visitation numbers in conventions, in tourists, and I mean the America's Mart. Have you ever been downtown when the America's Mart? It's just
massive.
Amazing.
These
people typically they fly into the busiest airport in the world. They catch MARTA in. They walk to their hotel somewhere around the Peachtree Center. What do they do at the end of the day? Well, they want to go out for something to eat, something to drink. Haven't got a car. How do they get there? Here's the streetcar, which for the first 3 months will be free. After that, it'll be a dollar. They'll hop on the streetcar, then they'll see shops and businesses and bars and restaurants they'll want to visit along the route.
Right.
So a dollar per way, is it per mile? What's the...
Well, the first 3 months is free. It's sort of a gift back to the people because, sure. You know, we've pulled a lot of streets up. It's been a lot of work. I mean, I've suffered through the dust and the noise. I live right over the streetcar track in Lucky Street. And then after that, it'll be three for free. So the first ride will be a dollar. The second ride will be another dollar. Then if you pay $3 and take three rides, the rest of the day is free. There's also some other tickets, special discounts, tickets for universities and colleges, and also a convention ticket that goes for 5 days at a discount. So we really capture. We want those conventionees moving around Atlanta and spending their money.
Right. Absolutely. So you mentioned getting into suburbs. Is there a timeline for that, or kind of key areas you're already looking at, so people can get kind of if you mention one of their places, they're going to be like, oh yeah, I want that to happen. Then you'll get some letters and you'll get a whole bunch of outreach.
A statement has been made by a city representative. They would like to see the first extension to the current streetcar network in the next 4 years.
So you're looking for see if this works, 4 year kind of trial period, and then you're going to start expanding to other areas, maybe in Atlanta, maybe outside of Atlanta, to kind of bring out that connection. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, the planning is well in advance, and one of the functions of the Beltline group is actually to plan the streetcar, the electric streetcar, along Beltline and other areas. A thing to remember about the streetcar too is, and after living in a streetcar city, which I have done, is that the streetcar also is a new attraction, and they call it transportainment.
All right. So, I'm interested.
They might need a new name.
So what you do, you think about, first of all, families. And families come to town, and they come to town. What do? They say, let's ride on the route bus. No, they typically don't say that.
Right.
They see the streetcar coming along and say, hey, Dad, hey, Mum, let's go on the streetcar. So straight away, it's an entertainment in itself. It then takes those people around to all the type of entertainment venues they could go to, whether it's the aquarium, goes close to the children's museum, close to bars, close to restaurants. So everything the family can want is along the way, but the ride itself to get there is also entertainment. So they're calling it transportainment, as well as an economic development tool, as well as transit.
So you guys are wearing a lot of different hats.
Yes, but the streetcars have always been like this. This has been the streetcar's purpose. Whether you're in Sydney, Australia, whether you're in San Francisco, whether you're in a European city, this has been the streetcar's purpose from day one, back late last century.
Well, I'm loving this because there's only one thing I hate more than driving in Atlanta, and that's being stuck in traffic in Atlanta.
You know, I think that are streetcars the solution for transportainment? No. Or transport. No, they're not. That's not solution. What the solution is, the right mix, so that we have automobiles, buses, scooters, cycles, walking, streetcars, trains. We've got the whole mix. America used to be too far on the rail side. They used to have huge networks, the biggest rail systems in the world. Most of them were taken out. Now they're realizing some have to come back in to put that balance back. So streetcars work with the right mix of other transportation.
So if you just rely on streetcars, it may not be as effective as having all these other options.
Well, we're the first streetcars in America that are allowing bicycles. You can just simply wheel your bicycle on. There's no lifting. It's level floor. You can just wheel it on. And then you stop, just wheel it off again. Because we're realizing that people use and want to use bicycles.
Sometimes they're going to want to not ride, just wheel it on, and they can ride from there wherever the nearest stop is, right?
Yeah, things are changing. You're seeing a lot of more people riding bicycles, especially over fine weather. You're seeing families, parents and their kids actually all riding cycles. So the streetcar needs to be a good community citizen and fit in.
So how does – because I know MARTA's kind of taken a better role in this too, but how do you ensure safety of passengers and – maybe a security feature?
The entire streetcar route is covered by video cameras on the outside, on the streets.
Sure.
The streetcars themselves have 8 video cameras inside and out, and at
wow.
the moment they're being connected up to the police center that monitors all that, so they can monitor real-time action inside the streetcar. Streetcar also will have police supervision, it will have its own staff, and also the ambassadors will be involved. You just see the downtown ambassadors, they're giving information to visitors and providing some security, it's just their presence. Because there'll be so many visitors on the streetcar, we'll be allowing the ambassadors to use the streetcars as well to supply the information. Remember, the project is actually 3 different groups. It's owned and operated by the City of Atlanta, but our other 2 partners are the Atlanta Downtown Improvement District and MARTA. And MARTA will be providing safety oversight for our rail operations.
So what I'm getting here is there's something for everybody here. You have, for families, you have something to do on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon, evening. You have people that need transportation continually down the block, down the street, or whatever, that instead of getting in their car to drive, they can just hop on your streetcar, and you have business-minded people that want economic development.
Yes. I've seen the whole gamut. When I was young, I caught streetcars to school.
Right.
When I was dating, when I told you I was in Melbourne, it was quite acceptable for you to get on one stop, your date to get on the next stop, your friends to get on to another, go out for a meal, go to a bar, go out to a club, and come home at 3 o'clock in the morning all on streetcars. As I get older, I'll be using streetcars to get around town right here in Atlanta. If I want to go down to the Auburn Market to get something for lunch or some supplies, I'll use the streetcar. If I want to go out for some drinks on a Friday or Saturday night, I'll use the streetcar. Why would I want to use my car when I'd have to pay to park it? I'd have to negotiate that traffic. Plus, there's the drinking thing, too. If I'm going to have a couple of drinks, I shouldn't drive.
Right, but I can take the streetcar.
You can take the streetcars and you meet different people as well. So there's an opportunity in that as well. Plus the businesses, we have some businesses that they're saying we lost one car park in the front of our business, and that's unfortunate for the station. But that means that every 10 minutes, a streetcar carrying 200 people is going to pull up outside your restaurant. That's a fairly good replacement to lose one parking spot.
Yeah, that's the bus stop effect. Everyone gets off and everyone comes in your store, so it's... That's huge for them. So real quick, where can people go to learn more about the Streetcar Initiative, you guys, and you personally?
You know, the best thing is to use Google and just Google Atlanta Streetcar.
Sure.
And you'll find all the information, all the news stories, both positive and not so positive on the streetcar website. Plus, you'll learn a lot of other areas, a lot of other cities in North America that have put in streetcar systems that are now extending streetcar systems because of ridership and the economic development they're bringing.
So one last time, when can we see this streetcar start going down the streets?
According to our schedule, and let's hope we don't have any more freezes because that just freezes.
We're supposed to get one more.
Our construction operation. We expect to see a streetcar moving under power, beginning testing end of April, and we believe the system will be ready for opening at the end of June.
That's right around the corner. You must be pretty excited about that. Mm-hmm. I know I'll be using it, so... Well, thanks for coming to the show. We're glad all of you could make it today. And catch us next time on Midtown Business Radio.